Thank you for raising the bar very high. Good morning. I'm very excited to be here. Glad to be invited and to give this talk here. I tried to separate or distinguish the presentation into actually four things. So I want to start by giving a look into the current state of knowledge that we have on online fragmentation, on online polarization, on algorithmic content creation, before I want to give you a glimpse at a research project that I'm currently trying to carve out, so the direction where I'm moving it. And then the third part, or the second half maybe, will focus a lot on computational methods, on ways how to investigate these things. And in the end, I will try to also provide a roadmap, at least my own roadmap, I think, where we as a field should move to integrate computational methods better into our daily routines. With that said, let's start. And I have to admit at first that I think algorithmic content curation is a great thing. Platforms like Google News help us to filter an enormously wide array of information that is available today. News is not only local, news is global. These days, that's not a new thing. And platforms that are algorithmically curated, such as news aggregators, help us to filter this enormous amount of information down to a digestible amount. And this filtering is necessary, of course. We cannot digest the whole of information that is out there alone. Filters help us to handle an information overload. And they do so by basing their selection, their filters, on a wide range of data signals, of data inputs, and data signals to filter news based on certain criteria. The certain criteria might be the thing that is most newsworthy, the news that are the latest news. That might also be the news that are most interesting to us. That might be the news that are most relevant to Oslo inhabitants. And this decision-making of which news is to be filtered is in constant progress. There are lots of different mechanisms at play, machine learning mechanisms, to name one buzzword at least, that are geared to improve over time, to filter based or to filter toward more, let's say, public well-being. The famous Google quote, "Don't be evil." We want to employ filters to make the society better, in a sense. But it could also be geared towards more optimized use. Facebook might not be interested in a public well-being, but might be interested in keeping you on their platform as long as possible. So they gear their machine learning, their recommender systems, their filters towards selecting the news that keep you on site by, for example, focusing on more emotion, by, for example, focusing on more things closer from your network, stuff like that. And it's also sometimes geared towards just your anticipated preferences. Now, some refer to this increasing filtering as a wider range as computational journalism, which, for example, Nick Diakopoulos and Kuliska defined as finding, telling, and dissemination of news stories with, by, or about algorithms. So they really placed it in a very, as I would call it, technology-determined perspective. They say it's all about the algorithms that are at play at this stage. But I think it's more than just that. So at the one hand, yes, this filtering, this capability of providing such algorithmically curated environments is because we are able to do it, because we can. Computational resources are cheap, are easy to employ, are widely available, and it's for everybody's at everybody's hand through smartphones, essentially. But I also think that this filtering and this data-based improvement of filters over time is also the result of because we kind of want it to. There is this belief that more data, more digitization, more information that we get from a lot of data is helping society. And I think that's not wrong in any sense, but it's also part of the game. We believe that employing more machine learning, for example, in medicine helps making medicine better. We use a lot of digitization, datafication tools because we believe it makes our daily routines more optimized. And as such, this fact-based, number-based, data-based decision-making is something that enjoys a lot of acceptance, which allows us to maybe even more openly like algorithmic content curation. And importantly, this has also increased some fears in the outcomes of it. All the news that's fit to print for Mario, in this sense. A daily me, and you can tell this is the same screenshot from before, but I clicked on the For You tab, and you can tell that I'm interested in gaming a bit, that I like cooking, I'm a vegetarian, I have shown interest in John Oliver, and you could probably guess also my political preferences from that. And here comes in personalization and this often feared and often discussed filter bubble. The idea that through algorithmic content creation that is geared toward me, over time, I'm increasingly shielded from detrimental information. I'm over time shielded from certain topics or actors or perspectives. They are constantly being blinded out. That's the theoretical assumption. That's the fear that Eli Pariser introduced and that has been echoed over and over again. And I have to admit, this has sounded intriguing. But if we look at today's empirical findings that we have so far, evidentially, it's maybe not as bad as we expected. If you look into research, more recent research, we see that personalization, for example, on Google News, does not really blind out certain topics or actors. People get more sports if they want more sports, yes, and I get more John Oliver than others, but I don't miss the main events. I don't miss a share of politics. We also don't see a strong limitation towards sources. We see a slight limitation towards sources. We see a slight bias that some sources that are better at search engine optimization, that are faster, are more in the stream of news that people get. But we don't see a systematic blinding out of certain outlets or certain news just based on algorithmic filtering. And if we try to investigate that over time, we also don't see that this blinding out, this filter bubble, is getting stronger or more shielded over time. That's also not really a thing, is what research currently tells us. Yes, there is some filtering taking place. Yes, these mechanisms work to some extent. We see differences in filters when we compare countries. We see differences in filters when we compare languages. And we see differences, for example, with regard to advertisements. There is research showing us that the advertisements that a young male gets are different than the advertisements that a young female gets, which I guess is fine. It's just not as problematic as it would be if the news were certainly different and would ignore certain topics overall, in general. Overall, however, this perspective, while being very technology determined, I think also introduces a normative perspective, saying that there is this set of news that everybody should know about, and now we can look at the filters and say, okay, how do they deviate from that? So this introduces this certain baseline that we are supposed to meet, but we don't really know how to agree on the baseline. What is the threshold that we compare it to? What's the set of news that everybody should have, and how can these filters deviate from that? That's a question that we haven't really been able to answer so far. Because some of these filters and recommender systems and algorithmic content creation or content curating systems help us as society. Yes, sources and ideas have fragmented and they thus call for filters in order for us to be able to digest the amount of it. But it also benefits a democracy. We see that the marketplace of ideas, this ideal of a discussion around certain political debates, has gained some improvements or has gained some traction online, on social media, for example. And we also see that not everybody who's putting something on social media is the one being read all the time. There is a bias where some people get read way more often than others, the famous long-tail distributions of the internet. Yes, we do see that people are sometimes geared towards niche media, but what research also shows us is that the people that use niche media, maybe the more problematic media users, are typically highly involved. So they also know about the mainstream news. They are not blinded out from other topics. And we also know that some people follow more ideologically biased outlets. We do know that the web, algorithmically content curating environments, also help people stumble over news incidentally, which is a good thing. So to sum it up at this stage, I think that this very technology-determined perspective of filter bubbles, where the evil algorithms filter us towards a chamber or a bubble, is not enough to look at. I think it is too technology-determined. People are still able to present and follow their own will. People get their political information also from a wider variety of sources. It's not only Facebook that provides people with news. That's an additional source, but it's not the sole provider of news. I think that this stream of research that I've just presented you is very much focused on the technological aspects and leaves out the social aspects of a lot of environments online, and I will come back to that in a second. And I also think that personalization in general entails the idea that also media effects that we tended to look at in the past, at least on a mass scale, are getting more personalized, more fragmented. In a way, echoing what Bennett and Iyengar have written a long time ago, that we are moving into this direction where we cannot look at, and we have been moving already into this direction, where we cannot look at media effects on a larger scale, but we need to look at it more individually. And this stock image girl is indicative of this being a slide that I'm very happy to discuss about later. So in order to apply a more personalized, in a sense, research perspective, I want to jump into what I'm trying to go for in the next, weeks, years, I don't know. We'll see where it takes me. But the main idea is that there are social aspects to online communication that have been left out in a lot of this research, I think. We know a bit about it. We know, for example, that weak ties, which are loosely connected individuals, for example, on Facebook, drive incidental news exposure. The more weak ties you have in your network, the more you are presented with news that you didn't intend to see. We also know that the strong ties, this is the people that are very close to you in their network, you feel very close to, if they share something, then you are more likely, or we are more likely, to share that on our own, pointing to the necessity also to look at these strong ties more thoroughly. You might refer to them as influencers, in a sense, be it on a smaller scale. On the negative side, we also know that homophily increases diffusion. That means that if you have you're in a network that where people share the same views, this increases the dispersion of news across this group. I also think that a more personalized research perspective would allow us to look at people's predispositions more thoroughly. We know that involvement plays a role, prior knowledge plays a role, interest, trust in the media are all aspects that mediate how a media environment affects us. And a more personalized research perspective would allow us to focus on this more thoroughly. And last but not least, I think that we have missed to look at different contexts in the past a lot. So we missed to integrate different research perspectives. For example, if we look at which news we stumble upon online, I think we have to integrate also, for example, the number of likes that come along with it, the person who shares it. And there is research focusing on all these aspects, but I think what we're missing or lacking is more integrative approach to kind of combine these assumptions. I want to show you an example of what I mean by that. A If yeah, so this is a not even so awkward tweet by the U.S. president on the very left top, saying Republican approval ratings just hit 93%. Sorry, haters, make America great again. And you can assume that this tweet is being seen by a lot of people. Yes. But not every person sees the tweet in its original form. You might see the tweet because you follow Lori Henry, who I don't know who she is, but she obviously has replied to the tweet saying that the president and a handful of Republicans accomplished this alone. Thank you for MAGA, making America great again. This we will cup, which is keep America great. So she's obviously in favor of it. And if you get to know the tweet by Donald Trump with her frame to it, if you will, that's certainly different than if you get the tweet by Donald Trump by following, for example, the Palmer report, which says fake approval rating, fake president, fake everything, but you're really going to die in prison. And as I said before, homophily increases the dispersion and the diffusion of news, and if you're following the Palmer report, you might be already in a very homophile environment. At least the Palmer report describes itself as political analysis ahead of the curve, followed by President Obama and Nancy Pelosi, blocked by Donald Trump Jr. Do the math. So they're clearly positioning themselves in a very liberal part of the political sphere. So to sum this personalized research perspective up, I think polarization has increased for some social segments. That is, we know that some people have been moved more and more into these homophile environments, and we need to look at them more thoroughly, but we cannot make the assumption that this is applying to all of the society. It's not applicable to everybody, it's not applicable to certain groups of people, but we need to look at these that are in these chambers, if you will. We know that different media make different people react differently. That's what I just showed you. There is research showing us that these different takes on the message affect us. And we see a constant, well, I would say re-rise of perceptional phenomena that increasingly play a role in explaining these effects. For example, the perceived minority-majority ratios, which I just said before, the number of likes that you see along a post affects how you take this post. Also, the comment below a post affects how we see a certain message. Opinion leaders, I mentioned that before, and you could put other perceptual phenomena in here as well. One more or less famous one is the truthiness effect, which has been brought forward by Stephen Colbert, late-night host, who said that we're increasingly getting into this atmosphere where it's not so much about what is actually true, but what I think is true, what I feel is the truth. Something is true because I have this impression that, rather than here's the facts, let's look at them. So if I want to start to carve out new research on that, I'm trying to put it into this realm of echo chambers, rather than the realm of filter bubbles. I think the main difference here is that echo chambers are looking at the social connections very thoroughly. They're not leaving out the algorithmic part, but they're just seeing the algorithmic part as one aspect to it and not the sole determinator of filter processes. Echo chambers also are not considered as a bad thing qua definition. Fragmentation thereby is seen both as a reason, both as a cause and a result of echo chambers. So in a sense, going into chambers to discuss certain issues is good. Breaking the whole public sphere up into public sphericules allows you to discuss on a level that with like-minded people, for example. It gets problematic as soon as it, kind of overstrains. If these individualized chambers, if these individualized sphericals don't talk to each other anymore. In that sense, and what prior research has shown us, I think it's more feasible to look at the context in which content is presented. It's maybe less about the tweet by Donald Trump, but the context in which you look at it, the context in which you are presented with it, the context in which you are facing it. For new research projects, I think we should re-highlight the role of opinion leaders, a rather old concept essentially, where this two-step flow of communication, later the multi-step flow of communication, said that there's people that use the news very thoroughly, and then they redistribute their knowledge to others. That's from a time where people did not have access to the news equally. So that's not the same concept as I would use it today, but still I think this concept of there are these individuals that A, consider themselves important in the sense that they show strong personalities and they show or think that they add value by sharing news, and B, also they are perceived to be influential by others. That's an important balance to make there, is a concept that is very valuable, especially in the realm of social networks that are very focused on individuals, such as Instagram or YouTube, for example. If we want to look at media effects on an, well, from a personalized or individualized perspective on a broader scale, I think these opinion leader effects also help us in the sense that we know that people are more affected by opinion leaders if they share certain characteristics. I'm more aligned or I'm more adhered to individuals if they, for example, are in my age group, if they are in the same life situation, if they have a similar socioeconomic status, or at least if I believe that they have. Well, to be put it very blunt, the old white men telling everybody what to do might not work for everybody, but for old white men. And the same goes for young adults and, well, the respective influencers there. We also know, when we look at individualized effects, that people are more susceptible to information if they're in need for cognition, if they're looking for orientation, in a sense, if they're in a phase in their lives where they seek to have anchors to attach to. So I think, again, this highlights a focus that we should put on a younger target group in our research, less at the very well-educated 40-plus, but more on younger adults and maybe even teenagers, because these are also the main target groups of influencers, of opinion leaders, in that sense. Also, if we look at young adults, if you look at teenagers, they are very susceptible to political information. We see from political studies, for example, a decrease in party ties. People tend to vote for different parties over the lifetime. So there is a much higher need for orientation in that sense, because you're not always voting for the same party over all over your lifetime. We see an increase in swing voters, people jumping from one party to the other. We also see an increasing susceptibility to personalization in the sense of presenting persons rather than issues when it comes to political information, when it comes to political advertisements, a presidentialization effect. You're not voting for the Republicans, you're voting for Donald Trump. And it's advertised as such, and that's not only a phenomenon from the US, but also all over Europe, where we see a strong increase in populist parties that they do marketing with certain topics. You all know that, but they are very strongly geared towards their top candidates, their leading candidates. I said the last point, I mentioned that before. And if you look at what people use as their sources of news, and this is data from the latest Reuters digital news report, we can see that, well, the question was which of these social networks do you use for news in the last week? And we can see that apart from Facebook being still the dominant network, it's decreasing though, we also see that the higher bars are for those networks that are really based on these, well, at least for the younger target group, based on these influencers, opinion leaders, very individual-focused communications, like YouTube, like Instagram, also WhatsApp, but that's harder to look at. For other reasons, we'll take a look at that later. So what I'm trying to do, and this is very early stage in a sense, and I'm looking forward to discussion on that as well. That's why I put the stock photo girl up here again, is I want to focus more on the role of opinion leaders when it comes to political information. I tend towards YouTube as an increasingly important source of information. That's what we see from different surveys, from kids, from teenagers, from young adults. With an overarching kind of like research question in the realm of how do opinion leaders on social networking sites, such as YouTube, affect our navigation, our consumption, and also our interpretation of political information. And I think it's very important to apply different perspectives to this research, which also prohibits me from starting right now because it's making this project so huge. But I think it's what we need is a more integrative perspective on both the communication side, but also the recipient and news consumer side. So I think we need to look at who are these people, who are these influentials that consider themselves influential, but are also considered by others as influential. What are they talking about? We don't know anything about that. What role do filters play? So here comes in the algorithmic content creation again, but it's not the main part. But still, what role does it play that I get suggestions at the right-hand side when I have ended watching a YouTube video or even automatically starting a new one? Is it driving me towards certain directions? There's anecdotal evidence, at least, of that. Who is actually watching that? And what role do these people play in these news consumers' diets, media diets? Are we talking about people that are very well integrated into daily discourse about news because they're, coming from families where news play a certain role? Or is this kind of like an alternative, a distinction channel? I'm not getting the news I want. That's why I reach out to my individuals that I find likable on YouTube, for example. And ultimately, what do we get from that? What do these people get from that? What does that make them do, think, feel? So this is a very broad sketch of what I'm trying to go for. But having said that, one major problem, and now we're facing the second half of the talk, is how? Because if media use is so personalized and so fragmented and so individualized, how could we actually investigate it? That's an increasingly important question. It might not be the most intriguing question to the public, but to researchers, how should we dig into this? How should we look at what people see with their different search histories, with their different approaches to YouTube, with their different networks also? The traditional approach, or the traditional approaches, are, for example, content analysis. Let's look at the content that is there. I don't think that this is outdated, but there is no fixed set of news that we can look at and say, let's content analyze that and we'll know what everybody saw. Think back from the Trump tweet. We can look at Trump tweets and we can content analyze them, but that's not really the whole story, is it? We can do surveys, and I think we still should do surveys, although response rates are going down, it's harder to talk to people, but surveys are valuable. However, these increasingly small exposure times, you're looking at your Instagram while you're waiting on the bus, is not maybe what you consider news use. And if you're then asked, hey, how often did you use X in the last week for news? That might not be top of your head. And we see research that compares survey results with observational results showing that there is a huge mismatch of what people tell they're using and what they're actually using when we observe them. There is an approach called in situ surveys, in situation surveys, which sends you a WhatsApp basically every now and then asking you, hey, right now, what was the last news you stumbled upon? And then you're probably capturing this last appearance of news on, I don't know, Instagram, Snapchat, wherever. But this is really burdensome in the sense that you can only capture very small exposure sites. It's not allowing for large scales at this point. And the last very traditional approach would be to observe people. And this is, well, we can sit behind or stand behind people and look at them, of course. But actually, there is one very easy approach, because all these algorithmically curated content environments do nothing else than observing or tracking us. So this data is available. Yay! Case closed. No. Fortunately not. Or unfortunately not. Because for these providers, for these platforms, it's not an easy thing to share their data with us being the researchers. For one, because why should they? It's their capital, in a sense. But for two, and this is, I think, not addressed very often, for some instances also, how could they? It's not that they have like this Excel spreadsheet of rules of when you are exposed to certain news posts or not. There is machinery behind that, and here's the key, the buzzword again, employing, for example, machine learning techniques, where there is no human making that decision, and extracting these rule sets is not as easy as it might have been in the past. However, they could do better in sharing data with us. They could at least show us the data points where they saw people facing a certain news, liking a certain news, sharing a certain news. And there has been a lot of pressure on that, public pressure also, and I like that this has gained some traction. Facebook has done two things. First, they have shut down their APIs a lot. Basically crippled their APIs, making it harder to get data out. But at the same time, they have introduced a platform, or a non-profit, I think, that is called Social Science One, which is a platform where they provide researchers with data and also money to conduct the research. And they asked researchers to present research ideas, so they would allow you to be part of that nice family. And in the first round, that was, I think that took place in March or something, earlier this year, they provided some nine projects to American scholars only. So there was a petition and an open letter following that saying, hey, you're not only a US player, maybe rethink that decision. So they included some people from Europe as well. But just recently, and I'm talking like 2 weeks ago, they have started to share the data with these selected scholars. But as it turns out, the data is not as nicely as it was promised. It was less data than it was promised, way less data than it was promised. It was on a higher aggregated level. Facebook says it's because of privacy restrictions, not that they knew before. So this play with, let's call it the devil, because it's so placative and so provocative in a sense, has currently turned to like this, we're on a leash of these platforms. And this is not a feasible situation, a sustainable situation, I think. So we need to probably move towards a way where we have our own methods, not reliant on these platforms' willingness to share data with us. And one way to look at it could be case studies. You sit down, you set up several, let's say, several computers, and you try to use Facebook in several different ways, and then you look how what information you get out of it. You basically simulate certain users, for example. Or you take a specific platform and you look at it very closely by following certain outlets only, certain opinion leaders only, certain influencers only, and look where that takes you. This is an okay approach, but it limits the number of exposure times, it limits the number of platforms to look at. There's just limits in capabilities of doing that. What other options do we have? We could apply discourse analysis, look at guidelines that these platforms have put forward. Have look at maybe the guidelines that also opinion leaders or influencers adhere to. Some of them are parts of networks. What do these networks tell them in probably internal documents? We could critically reflect on this, try to generate meaning from the language that is being used in these guidelines, which would be a good approach because it's an approach that we're quite used to. We don't need special new computational wizardry. But at the same time, it's limited to minor samples. It's limited in the sense that not every platform has these guidelines, has documents that we could look at that are very telling. A third approach that we're actually very good at is interviewing experts. We do that with, for example, social media managers or journalists, but we could also try to conduct more expert interviews with the developers behind these platforms, the project managers on these platforms. There are some studies in the information sciences that try to do that more from a, well, less from a normative perspective in how or why is this implemented, but more from a how do you implement it perspective, process-oriented in a sense. But the problem here seems to be, because there's not a lot of research on that, the problem here seems to be the same problem as with Social Science 1. The platforms are not really willing to let people speak to us. And if you're trying to reach out to companies, to software companies, saying that, hey, you're doing research, want to talk to the programmers' time, because it's so expensive, is very valuable to them. So it's hard to get people to talk to you in that sense. So an alternative approach that has been employed was to, well, okay, ignore the actors, ignore the platforms, let's just simulate everything. which has brought forward some nice findings. The idea here is that you set up a model of how social interactions work, and you set up this model in a way that you specify, well, these are users, users tend to do that, they're using Facebook X times a week, they're using, newspapers Y times a week. These are the newspapers, they provide information every now and then, and these are platforms, they are behaving, what we know so far, like that. And now let's simulate how this turns out when we let that run for like a week or so. This is a completely artificial setup, but that has shown us some circumstances under which we're moving more towards a polarized society versus environments where we're not moving, or we're moving away from such an environment. However, it's, as I said, it's a very artificial approach, and it's kind of limited by the assumptions that you make a priori to running it. The number of times people visit a Facebook page is a parameter you set in the beginning, and if you set that differently, you affect the outcomes, of course. Another even more recent approach is what I like to refer to as agent-based testing, which is an approach lended from information science. It's basically the same setup, as I said, with the case studies before, having several computers conducting something, but not looking at the several computers, but automating that to allowing a large range of automated profiles doing something. In that sense, it's also artificial because it employs automatisms, agents, hence the name. But it really, it doesn't simulate the whole environment. It really uses Google or Facebook or Instagram to actually simulate human behavior. And it does so by using, I think there's another slide on that. Yes, it does so by using tools from the information sciences that they use for testing. That's why it's called agent-based testing. So these tools are basically, it's basically software written to simulate human behavior in order to test software for bugs, for failures and stuff like that. But in this approach, agent-based testing, it's used to actually Google for certain terms, look what the results are, use Facebook in a certain way over a course of time, and then see which posts you stumbled over. This is a somewhat, well, it's the pros first. It allows this research of simulating behavior on a large scale. It allows to look at very personalized effects, in a sense. But at the same time, it's dependent on your prior assumptions. In that sense, it's very artificial again. And it's also a somewhat gray area in terms of the terms of service of these networks, because usually they do not allow you to do something automatically with their data. Although there's not a lot of... Well, there is some laws saying how far this can go, and there is also an exclusion to research, making it a somewhat gray area. But just to keep that in mind, this is an approach that somewhat interferes, at least with their terms of service. And the last thing I know of, at least, that has been used in the past, and we've done that... I've done it myself as well, is to do the observation, standing behind person and looking over their shoulders on a large scale, on an automated scale, by essentially using browser plugins. So you create a browser plugin, you disseminate that, people install it, and whenever people use, for example, Facebook, the browser plugin would collect some very limited amounts of data. In our case, we looked at all the publicly shared posts only, without personal information. So we only knew what you saw with how many likes along with it and whether you liked it or shared it and stuff like that. So that is a feasible approach. However, there's also another slide on that. However, I have to say that we have had huge difficulties in recruiting people. People are not very willing to help research in the sense that they install a browser plugin. Also, there is technological limitations. Browser plugins are bound to these computers, but not your smartphone. And you're losing apps. So if people use Facebook through the app, they're out of your observational reach, in a sense. You have to make sure not to interfere with, in this case, law, not terms of service. Also terms of service, but... law in the sense of privacy regulations, because while people who install the plugin might have agreed to participate in that, you're collecting posts under which other people might have commented. So you need to make sure not to capture these posts or at least anonymize that at the point of data collection. So there's these methods, if we want to look at them all together, especially the last ones, agent-based modeling, agent-based testing, browser observations, are the methods where this kind of computational wizardry comes in, where not everybody is capable of doing that. And I still believe that these are very valuable roads to follow to foster research in that sense. But it's a long way to go there, I believe. And you might have seen or realized that these are only methods for data collection. The kinds of data that we get from these approaches also require us to adapt our analysis tools to some extent. Just to mention a few, we might need to think about nonlinear approaches, we might need to think about semi-automated or automated content analysis more thoroughly, etc. So this is what I've been trying to do in the last couple of years, but I think that this should, and there are others like me that try to look at this, but I think that to move forward as a field, we need to include these, not only these few methods, but also the development of such new methods more thoroughly into our research routines. So in a sense, to put it onto a broader scale, to make it, put it on a macro perspective, I think we need to move forward and establish certain criteria in order to foster such innovation, because what we see increasingly is that the social scientific yet technology-savvy questions are not asked to social scientists. They're asked to IT people, which is okay from a technological perspective, but as I said before, that's only one part of the problem or the solution. So here's, I think it's the last stock photo girl. I think we're facing a couple of structural challenges here that we as a field should address. I think there is lots of ideas and some innovation also in the methods section. But it lacks a couple of aspects. I want to highlight them, a few of them, and also want to suggest a few steps to move forward. There is rare methodological incentivation. There's in academia not a lot, in social sciences especially, to get out of if you put your efforts into creating these tools. Yes, it's nice. Yes, it helps you move forward with your research, but it's there's not a lot of incentivation in terms of where you get with that. There's some IT knowledge dispersed across different institutions, but only rare academic institutionalization. That means we don't teach computational wizardry to students. Or do you? We don't, at least. Yes, we teach statistics and stuff like that, but we don't teach how to use APIs. We don't teach how to think about the data that gets out of APIs, which is, well, it has downsides and upsides, right? There are some exceptional approaches. I've mentioned a few. I've also cited a few. But there's only rare tool professionalization. Other fields are way ahead of us in that sense. There's no list of tools that you could reach out to if you're doing a project and don't know about this. And, well, once we would reach that point, we're struggling with replication. But we're struggling with replication anyhow, so that's maybe not a computational methods problem. So we can, maybe not our daily us, but our future us should handle the replication part. What does that mean? I don't think that every social scientist or every social scholar needs to code. But I do think that we need a more professional environment where those that can code, the computational folks, in a sense, are able to get something out of it and also present it and provide it to others and others to be able to understand it. Because this comes with a lot of problems. For example, reviewing. Who is able to review these approaches? This is a systematic problem, but I think this is a problem that can, for example, be addressed by journals, by asking submissions to include readable code. Information science, for example, asks for pseudo code. So it's this human readable code that everybody who cannot code still can read. It doesn't run on itself. It's an additional effort to take, but it allows others to review what the tools did. That's not a thing in communication science at all, as far as I know. There's only very rare journals that ask to open up data for replication. There's some, encouraging it, but not a lot of journals enforcing it. I know political communication has started to enforce it now, and you have to have good reason not to do it, and they have to decide on that. I don't know of any tools that are undergoing software testing in our field, because it would be the same people doing that, but software needs to be tested. Does it really do what it says it does? We're not enforcing that right now. And for especially looking at the data collection tools that I've presented, we could do some sort of pre-registration. We could allow some sort of pre-registration for data collection. Here is what I'm going to do. Here's the tool I'm going to use. Please review that first, and afterwards I'm collecting data in order to validate that this data that I collect has some value to it. We're allowing pre-registration already for experiments, in a sense, but I think this would be a valuable addition to adding to the quality of this, of these tools and to make them more sustainable. I do think we need a stronger institutionalization. I said the study programs already. I mentioned that before. But also we need incentives for the computational folks to build the dictionaries, the archives, the tools, and to provide them. Currently, there's not much to get out of it, apart from maybe being the second or third author in the method section of the paper. But that's not, I don't think this is sustainable in a sense. And ultimately, if we manage to establish structures that are able to incentivize, structures that are able to increase the quality, structures that are able to allow a very professionalized approach, I think we even need to go further and try to also fund research that is ready to maintain these tools, because currently, if we have these rare exceptions of tools that are being published, are being presented, are being used, thinking of tools such as the Face Pager, if you're familiar with that, which is a great tool to employ APIs also for non-coders. This is a tool that could easily be taught in courses and classes. But Jacob, who is maintaining it, is doing the maintenance in his free time. That's not a solid basis and foundation to build on, to build our research on. So in that sense, I think we need more exchange in that sense. We need more professionalization and some groups and talks like this, but also connections, for example, the ICA computational methods, but also others, are trying to establish that more and more. And I feel that we're on the right track, but we're at the very beginning of this road, and I hope that I was able to convince you to follow me a bit on that road. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention and look forward to lots and lots of questions.